So our passage this evening is Judges chapter 16, verses 21 to 31. And this then is the final installment in the Samson narrative. And I guess it would be somewhat incongruous if this action-packed saga ended quietly and uneventfully. And I think it's fair to say that it doesn't. It ends grippingly. It ends dramatically. It ends with twists and turns. More specifically, it ends with a cluster of conquests. And it's those conquests then that I would like us to focus on this evening, and there are three of them. So first of all, the conquest of Samson. The conquest of Samson. So we broke off last week at rather a critical moment. Samson has given away his secret. His hair has been cut. Yahweh has left him, and he's in a room full of Philistines. But of course, this is Samson, and so yes, he may be in a predicament, but surely you think the game can't be up. Surely Samson must have some plan B. Surely even now he'll have something up his sleeve, some way of getting out of this sticky situation. I mean, Samson always does. And so you can't help thinking perhaps in those terms here. Well, verse 21 emphatically disabuses us of all such notions, doesn't it? It's a difficult verse to read. Verse 21. I mean, we're accustomed by now to violence in this book of Judges, but verse 21 is different. This is violence laced with dreadful poignancy, because of course this isn't Eglon or Sisera or some other oppressor of God's people receiving his comeuppance. I mean, we can almost enjoy the X-rated goriness in those instances, but this is the champion of God's people. This is the mighty hero of Jawbone Hill. This is Samson, whom we have known and loved since the days of our children's story Bibles, and now he has been brutally, excruciatingly, barbarically conquered by the Philistines. But actually, Samson's conquest by the Philistines, real and distressing as that is not what I'm referring to in this first heading this evening. Someone else conquers Samson here. God conquers Samson. Let me explain what I mean by that. Samson has been bedeviled, hasn't he, throughout his career. He's been bedeviled by these two great problems which have repeatedly driven him off the rails. One is his eyes. You remember how he has kept on seeing illicit women and going after them. The other is his self-reliance. We saw this particularly last time. That sense of invincibility. I can exercise my strength whenever I please, irrespective of how I'm behaving. That kind of attitude. And of course, these two things then, his eyes and his self-reliance. Because of them, Samson has been, morally speaking, this wild, untamed, out of control guy. Yes, he has had some wonderful moments, moments where we have admired him, and moments where it's been thrilling to observe him. But always, there has been with Samson this sense of an accident waiting to happen, hasn't there? You never know when he's next going to erupt and some reckless act of sin is going to explode out of this man's life. But here now in this passage, God deals with both of Samson's two problems. He deals with the problem of Samson's eyes, and he deals with the problem of Samson's self-reliance, so that suddenly we have a different Samson on our hands. A tamed Samson. A Samson who has been conquered, actually in the best possible sense. So first of all, his eyes. And God deals with that problem then in the most straightforward manner, doesn't he? Samson's eyes are removed. You know, it's interesting. that Samson is mentioned in Hebrews chapter 11, Hebrews 11:32, that great catalogue of men of faith, men and women of faith in the Old Testament period. And Samson is included in that catalogue. And of course, as I've so often said before, we always need to bear in mind with Hebrews 11 that it's faith in a very particular sense that is being focused on. Not so much that saving, justifying faith that Paul talks about so often, that helpless dependence upon the finished work of Jesus Christ, that's not really the faith in view in Hebrews 11. Faith in Hebrews 11 is that future orientation, that looking forward to the reward, as it's put in verse 26 in connection with Moses, that looking forward to the world to come, even though it's presently so invisible, it's presently so unseen, faith in Hebrews 11 is clinging to the promises that mean it must transpire. And Samson then is identified as a man of that kind of faith. And you read the Samson narrative then, in the light of Hebrews 11:32, and you think to yourself, well, when does Samson exercise this faith? When is he preoccupied with the world to come? He seems far too preoccupied with the delights of the Philistine female form to be preoccupied with the delights of the world to come. Well, yes, that's true, he is, until that is this point in the narrative. And he's not now preoccupied anymore with the delights of Philistine women. And presumably then, Hebrews 11:32 is referring to the last part of his life. His eyes have been the medium of that preoccupation with the here and now, and particularly that preoccupation with illicit women. And the removal of his eyes then, as it were, releases Samson to have this new preoccupation. It frees him to be preoccupied now with the world to come. He is released from the fetters of his eyes that are tying him to the here and now, and he's able now to focus on a world that lies in the future. And then the other thing that God deals with is Samson's self-reliance. That's gone too, isn't it, in our passage? We no longer have a Samson here thinking that he's invincible. Verse 26 is so full of pathos, isn't it? Samson said to the young man who held him by the hand. Samson is now dependent upon a young lad to lead him places. This isn't Samson the invincible anymore. And then, of course, you have his prayer in verse 28. And it's so different, isn't it, from the tone of verse 20 when he was there in Delilah's house and his hair has been cut off, but he still wakes up saying, I will go out as at other times and shake myself free. I may have been a fool, I may have given away my secret, but that doesn't matter. I can still beat these Philistines. There's nothing of that now in verse 28. He doesn't think now he can effortlessly pull down these pillars, but rather he appeals desperately to Yahweh. Will you strengthen me this one more time? Now, of course, Samson, even in this final scene, he's certainly not perfect. And that comes across in that prayer too, doesn't it? Where he does add the clause in verse 28 that I may be avenged on the Philistines for my two eyes. It's a motive that we've seen with previous judges. You think of Gideon and how he was driven at one point, wasn't he, by the desire to avenge the deaths of his brothers. And there's a bit of that here with Samson. So he's certainly not the finished article by any means, but he's definitely different. He's an improved version of the Samson that he had been. And of course, we have to mention then this obvious fact, don't we, that this improvement in Samson has come about at a massive, massive cost to Samson. God's taming, God's conquering of Samson here is hideously painful and unpleasant. So that we're kind of confronted actually with a paradox, aren't we, as we view Samson here in this passage. At one level, this Samson who now shuffles along, unable to see where he's going, this Samson who prays in such an unsure fashion, at one level, this Samson is a pale shadow of his former self, a pitifully reduced version of the larger-than-life figure we've been tracing throughout these previous chapters. But then at another level, Samson has never been in better health than he's in now. Because now he's fixing his eyes not on what is seen, but on what is unseen. For what is seen is temporary, but what is unseen is eternal, as Paul puts it. Now he's depending humbly on his God in prayer. And perhaps you know something of this paradox in your own experience. Perhaps there was a time in your life when you really seemed to be making it. You were going places. You had a well-paid job and you had a big house and you had a spring in your step as you bounced through life. And perhaps you're at a place now where things are very, very different. And you're struggling to get work and you have aches and pains in your body. And money is tight and life seems to be passing you by now. That's how other people would view you. And sometimes you're tempted to view yourself in those sad terms. But at other times you are actually able to recognize, no, I'm healthier now than I was then. I'm an improved version of myself compared to what I was then. Because God, through reducing me, and through cutting me down and through shrinking me, has actually grown me and has made me humbler and has made me more dependent upon himself and has made me more clear about what life is and how short it is and that there is an eternity stretched before us. And it's been dreadfully, dreadfully painful, yes, but I'm glad. I'm glad for this process that has occurred. You know, there are wonderful little touches of divine ownership, subtle little touches of divine ownership in this passage. So there's the hair growing back there in verse 22. And of course, we must be clear, Samson's strength does not reside magically in his hair. Hair can't make you strong. Samson's strength resides in the help of God, the Holy Spirit coming upon him. That's where Samson's strength resides. But nonetheless, it's when he is living in accord with his Nazarite status and keeping his hair long that the Spirit does that. And so there is significance to his hair growing back here. It is God speaking to Samson in a not dissimilar way to how the Lord Jesus speaks to Peter on the beach that morning by the Sea of Galilee, and Peter thinks he's blown it and it's all over for him. And yes, he might have been forgiven, but there's no more usefulness now to the master for Peter. He can't now serve Jesus anymore. And three times Jesus says, feed my sheep. I've got work for you, Peter. You've denied me. You've sunk very low, but I've still got work for you, Peter. And as Samson's hair just starts to grow back again, it's God saying to Samson, I'm not finished with you. I'm not done with you. I've still got work for you, Samson. And then the other subtle little touch is at the other end of the passage, the burial that takes place. And of course, it's Samson's brothers and family who actually instigate this, but surely behind it we can see the hand of God. And you see, you've got to appreciate the significance of Samson's prayer in verse 30, the last prayer. Let me die. Maybe not a prayer, it's the wrong word, but his cry. Let me die with the Philistines. Such a contrast, isn't it, to Jawbone Hill, where he wanted his thirst quenched so that he wouldn't die amongst the uncircumcised Philistines, because he didn't want them to perform indignities upon his corpse. But now he's saying, let me just die amongst the Philistines. And I think he's probably saying, I've basically lived as a Philistine for much of my life. I've failed as an Israelite. I might as well die amongst the Philistines, because that's pretty much all that I am. And then, as Samson is buried, not amongst the Philistines, but back in Israel, is it not God saying, no, Samson, you're still an Israelite. You're still mine. You're still one of my people. You have lived in a messed up way, but you're still one of mine. So there are these lovely touches of ownership, and it's of a piece with that then, that God goes to such lengths to humble and refine and improve Samson. Indeed, the biggest indication of God's ownership of Samson, God being possessive about Samson, isn't those subtle little touches. It's everything between. It's the fact that Samson has now been reduced to this shuffling, pitiful individual. That, more than anything, shows that God is being possessive about Samson. He will go to those lengths to refine Samson and to conquer the wildness in Samson's character. And perhaps tonight then, you're finding things tough and you're being afflicted. And of course the temptation is to think, isn't it, God doesn't care. God doesn't care. Whereas actually it's perhaps an indication of just how possessive God is toward you. That he is going to significant lengths to humble you and shape you and make you more like the Lord Jesus Christ. So that's the first thing and the main thing tonight, the conquest of Samson. But then secondly, notice the conquest of the Philistines. The conquest of the Philistines. Because of course we must never get so absorbed with what is going on in Samson and what's happening in terms of his development and his character that we forget what Samson's role is. Why Samson has been raised up at all. His role, of course, is to be the deliverer of God's people from their enemy, the Philistines. And we've traced him then fulfilling that role, haven't we, at various points. Initially in striking down those 30 Philistines in Ashkelon after the wedding, and then striking down an unspecified but presumably large number of Philistines at the beginning of chapter 15, and then of course on Jawbone Hill, killing 1,000 Philistines. And what we have now in this passage then is Samson's last and Samson's greatest victory over the Philistines. And throughout this series in Judges, we've been identifying, haven't we, recurring features in the many tales of deliverance. And a couple of those recurring features are here then in our passage. On this occasion, we don't have the Spirit of the Lord mentioned. That's probably because the narrator feels it unnecessary. Because here, of course, this victory takes place in answer to Samson's prayer. And so it's very obvious that God is bringing this about, and so the narrator doesn't need to stress the operation of the spirits. But we do then have, as I say, a couple of the features we've seen before recurring here. One is humour. Humour. And I guess the main source of humour then in this victory narrative is Philistine stupidity, isn't it? I mean, we've just mentioned Samson's hair beginning to grow there in the prison cell. Now, you'd have thought if the Philistines had their wits about them at all, the one thing they would have made sure didn't happen was that Samson's hair grew again. And yet, because of some oversight, they allow Samson's hair to grow again. Well, then there's the idea that this bright idea they have there in Dagon's temple of having Samson come and entertain them at this large do that is taking place. I mean, you think about the last time that Samson was involved in the entertainment at a large do. It was his own wedding, and he was organizing the entertainment, and that ended fairly nastily for the Philistines, with 30 of them being struck down. You'd have thought they wouldn't have been so keen on involving Samson in the entertainment this time, but they clearly haven't learnt their lesson. Or then there's the fact that they make Samson stand between the pillars. It's interesting, it's not his choice. They made him stand between the pillars at the end of verse 25 there. It's interesting, isn't it, how Samson has kind of moved on as the story of his life has progressed. He's moved on from victimizing animals like lions and foxes, and he's become more interested with architectural structures. And so he's demolished those gates at Gaza. And it doesn't seem a very good idea then to place Samson between the pillars in Dagon's temple. It's stupidity. It's the equivalent of Eglon, you remember, kind of getting up to hear what Ehud's message was and so making himself vulnerable to the dagger being thrust into his belly. It's the equivalent of Sisera falling asleep in Jael's tent and making himself vulnerable to her murder. Abimelech going too near the door of that tower and making himself vulnerable to the millstone coming crashing down on him. And here these stupid Philistines make themselves vulnerable to the house literally being brought down as they place Samson between the pillars. But the humour is also there just in the way the narrative is written. It's slow motion, isn't it? Again, a bit like the killing of Eglon, or the killing of Sisera in Deborah and Barak's account of it in the song. And the pace slows down so that we kind of watch every single detail. And it's a bit like that here, because we're actually told of the pillars, first of all, back in verse 25. That's where Samson takes up his place, between the pillars. And yet it's not until we get down to verse 30 that we have the account of him actually pulling or pushing the pillars down. And so there's this kind of relishing of the details. You get it especially in verse 27, where the narrator just steps back and shows us these 3,000 Philistines on the roof, and they're just so enjoying the show that's taking place. Samson making a fool of himself, and it's just another detail to add to the enjoyment then when the pillars are brought down. Oh, then there's the wonderful touch with Samson's words in verse 26. He says to this young man, "Let me feel the pillars on which the house rests, that I may lean against them." And it's a bit like that Mr. Bean Christmas show where Mr. Bean gets the turkey stuck on his head. And you remember how he's staggering around his house with this turkey stuck on his head, and his girlfriend, she comes and she hasn't seen him yet, and she says, "Have you got the turkey on?" And of course it's funny, because the two levels of meaning, she means, "Have you got it on in the oven?" And he actually has got it on, stuck on his head. And similarly here, there's kind of two levels of meaning, that to the young man, Samson just wants to lean against the pillars because he needs a rest, just in the way that you might lean against a wall as you're chatting to someone. But of course we know that Samson's really going to lean against these pillars. He's going to lean all his spirit-given weight against these pillars. And so there's this humour. It's interesting that the word entertain calls Samson that he may entertain us. And they brought him and he entertained them. It's the same word, the same Hebrew word, which in Psalm 2 is used of Yahweh laughing at the wicked as they rage against him and against his Messiah. And here, actually, it's not the Philistines who have been entertained in the last analysis. It's Yahweh. It's the sovereign ruler of the skies who is being entertained as his enemy is being defeated. So humour, and then the other feature that we've seen several times, unconventionality. Unconventionality. I mean, verse 30 is so bold, isn't it? It doesn't link the Philistines' demise with the falling masonry of the temple, does it? It links the Philistines' demise with Samson's death. More that the dead whom he killed, not through bringing a temple down, but at his death, were more than those whom he had killed during his life. As if to say, the instrument of this victory was his death. And that then is the most unconventional instrument we've encountered yet, isn't it? More so than Ehud's left hand. More so than Shamgar's ox goad. More so than Jael's tent peg. More so than Samson's donkey's jawbone. This is really unconventional. The instrument in this conquest of the Philistines is death, the deliverer dying. And this one then takes us closer, doesn't it, than any of those other instances do, to Jesus, the greater than Samson. It's interesting, back in verse 17, which is in last week's passage, but we have Samson finally sharing his secret with Delilah, and he says, "A razor has never come upon my head, for I have been a Nazarite to God from my mother's womb." In the Greek version of that, it's, "I have been a holy one to God from my mother's womb." And that title, "a holy one to God," is used of only one other person in the Greek Bible, and that is Jesus. It's used 3 times in the Gospels. And more interestingly still, two of those occasions, but it's two Gospel accounts of the same instance, it's a demon that is referring to Jesus as the Holy One of God. In Mark chapter 1, Jesus is in the synagogue, and there's that man with the withered hand, and he has an unclean spirit, and we're told then in verse 24 that the spirit cried out, "What have you to do with us, Jesus of Nazareth? Have you come to destroy us? I know who you are, the Holy One of God." Same phrase that Samson uses to describe himself. Perhaps deliberate. Perhaps the demon recognizing that Jesus is to the whole realm of demons what Samson was to the whole realm of Philistines. The conqueror, the crusher, the slayer. And how then was Jesus going to, how was that Holy One of God going to conquer the demonic realm? The instrument would be death, the cross. By death he destroyed him who had the power of death, Hebrews 2:14. And all then, these unconventional victories of Judges and other parts of the Old Testament, they're all pointing us to the most unconventional victory of all, and particularly this one where Samson conquers the Philistines through dying. It's pointing us to Calvary, where Jesus conquered the powers of darkness through dying. And if those words sound bland to us tonight, I guess it's because, and we were talking about this at Time Out on Tuesday, it's because we have so swallowed the naturalistic narrative of our society around us, and we don't really see the pressing relevance of demons and the powers of darkness and Satan. And yet, of course, in biblical terms, they are enormously, gigantically relevant. This is the great problem that we face by nature. We're in the grip of Satan. We're under his dominion. This is the problem the universe faces. It's been invaded by Satan and his forces. And the wonderful thing about Jesus is that at Calvary he conquers the powers of darkness. He conquers the evil one. He destroys the works of the devil. He makes a public spectacle of the powers and authorities on high. And we should rejoice then. This humor we've talked about. Why is there humor in Judges 16? Because the Israelites are celebrating Samson's victory. how much more reason do we have to celebrate Jesus' victory through his death at Calvary? So the conquest of Samson, the conquest of the Philistines, thirdly and finally, the conquest of Dagon. The conquest of Dagon. There's been some discussion over recent days as everyone's been analysing England's performance at the World Cup finals. There's been some discussion whether all this singing of its coming home, whether that has been counterproductive and whether then it made the opposition play harder. It riled them. This kind of typically arrogant English attitude that it's coming home. Well, I don't know whether that's true. I don't know whether that hit a raw nerve with the Croatians. But I think the Philistines here in our passage hit a raw nerve with Yahweh. Because there's one and only one reason, isn't there, why Samson has been captured, why the Philistines have been able to get their hands on him. It's because, as we were told in verse 20, Yahweh left him. The Philistines don't see it in those terms. They don't say, "Thank you, Yahweh, for abandoning Samson so that we could get our hands on him." They interpret it in an entirely different way, don't they? They interpret it as the work of Dagon, this god of theirs. I think that's probably why in verse 21 they make Samson grind at the mill. Dagon, it seems more than likely, was a corn god. It's also, of course, why the Philistines were so upset when Samson sent the foxes through the fields burning up their corn. That was an affront to their deity, their corn god. And here now that they've captured Samson, they send him to grind in the mill. He's a trophy of Dagon's, the great god of corn. And of course, it's also why then they organise this huge worship event and they get their worship leader to write a new song for the occasion. And they have such a merry time praising Dagon for the capture of Samson. They've clearly never read Isaiah 48. Of course, they couldn't have read Isaiah 48 because it hadn't been written yet. But they clearly have never come across the sentiments of Isaiah 48 in verse 11 and those great words of Yahweh. "How should my name be profaned? My glory I will not give to another." He won't give his glory to another. He won't give his glory to Dagon. And he doesn't give his glory to Dagon, does he here? It's interesting that at the end of the Samson narrative, there's so much we don't know. We don't know the extent, really, to which Samson has dented the Philistines. We know that he hasn't completely wiped them out. In fact, we were told he wouldn't even before he'd been born, that he would begin the deliverance of Israel from the Philistines. David will bring it to a conclusion hundreds of years later. But we just don't know. We don't have a real sense. It's hinted, I guess, in verse 27 that the lords of the Philistines were there and they were killed. And so presumably it was a fairly significant dent in the Philistine oppression that Samson made. But we don't know exactly the extent to which he hurt the Philistine oppression of Israel. There's so much we don't know. But what we do know at the end of the narrative is that Dagon has been exposed as a false god. Dagon has been well and truly conquered. And Yahweh, on the other hand, has been emphatically affirmed as the living and the true God. And it's as if then this story of Israel and her situation in the latter part of the second millennium BC. This story that we've been following over these recent weeks. It's as if that story suddenly now becomes subservient to a bigger story. The story of Yahweh affirming his glory and his status as the true and living God. In fact, the more you study the Bible, the more and more you realize, don't you, that that's how the Bible works. I mean, it's full of stories. It's full of story after story after story. And yet, the more you get a feel for the Bible, the more you appreciate that all of them, the story of Moses, the story of Daniel, the story of Samson, the story of David, they're all, in fact, subservient to this bigger story of Yahweh affirming that he is God and he alone is to be exalted. In fact, even that story I touched upon a moment ago, even the central one of all the stories, the story of Jesus coming to this world and dying on the cross, even that is subservient to this bigger story of Yahweh asserting that he is God. So that the omega point of the Bible is not a multitude no man can number being washed clean of their sins, the ransomed church of God being saved to sin no more. That is a great point. But the Bible's omega point, the Bible's ultimate goal, lies beyond that. It lies in those great words that Paul gives us in 1 Corinthians 15, that moment that will come when God is all in all. Or that moment that Isaiah describes in Isaiah chapter 2, the Lord alone will be exalted in that day and the idols will utterly pass away. That's where history is heading. The goal of the story is beyond you and beyond me and beyond Israel and beyond any human being. The goal of the story is the glory of God and God being clearly demonstrated throughout his universe to be the only God that there is. So that we need to have a particular understanding of Christianity. So often, I guess, so often we think of Christianity in these terms, that it's kind of, it's me enlisting God into my little story. C.S. Lewis in Screwtape Letters, there's a bit where the senior demon is saying to his junior apprentice, he's saying, our greatest victory is when we can persuade them, that's when we can persuade Christians, that when they say my God, when they call God my God, they mean it in the same sense that they say my boots are my boots. Just this thing that I have a claim on, that I possess. And that's how we often think, isn't it, of Christianity. It's me asking God into my little life story to help me and be there for me. And I'm saying it's completely the other way around. And to become a Christian is to recognize the hugeness of God and to say, Lord, I want my little story to become a sentence, a clause, perhaps even just a footnote in your great story of you becoming the God who alone will be exalted in that day. Are you a Christian? Have you said that? Have you been caught up in the great story of the universe? God being recognized as God, all rivals smashed and blown away. That's biblical Christianity. May we catch that vision, all of us. Amen.